This is Potterwatch Radio, brought to you by your nearest audio device.
Potterwatch Radio, and I'm your host, Potter Watcher. This is the 9th episode of the Potterwatch Radio series. Today, on our last episode of this season, we're going to be talking to Heather O'Malley, an English scholar, about the various literary allusions in the Harry Potter books. The Harry Potter stories derive a lot of material from all kinds of other sources, especially ancient mythologies. Let's talk about a few of these legends.
There's a number of them. One of the most prominent is it does take a lot from the Arthurian legends. One of the things a lot of people don't know is the Arthurian legends aren't really English. They're actually French, and they're derived from the works of Chrétien de Troyes and a couple of other French authors, including some like The Quest for the Holy Grail, which is more of a religious-based book, but no one is quite sure who wrote that one. And they were all pulled together by Malory in La Morte d'Arthur, which basically is a compendium of a lot of the Arthurian stories. It also derives bits and pieces from Celtic lore, things from the Mabinogion, which is Welsh lore, as well as bits and pieces from the lore of other places around the world.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. Let's see. In the Arthur legends, there is references to, like, the names of the characters. There's Arthur Weasley. There's Percival, Percy Weasley. Ginny Weasley, Ginevra, is kind of a derivative of Guinevere.
Which would make sense if Harry were the Arthur of the story. Which does make sense, because he is the orphan who is left to be raised by a family. Though generally, in the traditional Arthur stories, the stepbrother, Kay, becomes a good friend and supporter. And we know that that's not quite the case in Harry Potter now, is it?
No, but we can definitely, I would say definitely, be able to compare Dumbledore to Merlin.
Definitely. I mean, he is, after all, has the highest award from the Order of Merlin. The Order of Merlin is the most powerful wizard of his generation, and actually several generations on either side. And so that does make some sort of sense.
In the Arthurian legend, Merlin has his downfall and in being seduced by the beautiful, powerful woman, in the same way Dumbledore is kind of seduced by this powerful wizard, Grindelwald. And that's ultimately not necessarily his downfall, but we would definitely say that that's his moment of weakness.
Merlin does have a number of moments of weakness. Depending on the source material, the legends you're looking at, he has either had a relationship with Morgan Le Fay, which is someone who is related to Arthur through Uther Pendragon, his father, or through, I think her name is Ninane. She is listed as possibly half-elf, possibly elf. But either way, she is this woman who sort of seduces Merlin and then freezes him in a cave.
And speaking of the Arthurian legend, you referenced the Holy Grail, which we could kind of say in the last book is a big part of the book, is that they're looking for Hufflepuff's cup.
Yes, Helga Hufflepuff's cup, which is, to a degree, an allusion to the Sangreal, the Holy Grail. Sangreal meaning the cup of blood, which, according to legend, is the cup that captured the blood from Jesus' side as it was pierced by the sword by Longinus, who is the legionnaire.
And then even in the Arthurian legend, the legend is that the Grail is a wondrous gold or silver jeweled bead-studded cup, which is the same in the book, that the cup is more plain, right?
If I remember correctly. But yeah, the legends all support that the cup, that the Grail, is actually not all that adorned. In fact, in the Grail stories, there's more to the Grail than it's just this magical cup that had the blood of Christ. There's an entire separate mythology thing that's tied into it, which is the story of the Fisher King, and the Fisher King was a king who had wounds and was suffering similar to the wounds of Christ. And as his health waned, so did the health of the kingdom. And it was only through the blood of the Grail that he was able to be fully cured. And that couldn't occur in the Holy Grail story in La Morte d'Arthur until Sir Galahad went through the quest and was able to retrieve the cup and thus present it to the Fisher King so he could be healed. There are some interesting ties to the Fisher King story. Since the Fisher King is a ruler who is ill, you can look at the fact that in the wizarding world there is an illness within it, this darkness that fills this space, and that darkness is pretty much Voldemort. And as this illness spreads, one of the things that Rowling talks about is that with the Death Eaters, there's this illness there that draws them, and that's similar to the illness that ate away at the kingdom in the Fisher King, until the Grail is obtained, and thus it can heal the wound to the king. Nothing can happen, and the kingdom is in this place of stasis. Kind of like, if you look at it this way, Voldemort's defeat, if you will, at the hands of Harry when he was a baby, basically put everything on hold until that fight was able to finish, and so therefore you have this place of stasis where the original darkness created by the Death Eaters, it doesn't necessarily get worse, but it doesn't necessarily get better either. And until Harry gives his sacrifice, it is at that point that the wound can start to be healed. Because if you look at it in the overarching Arthurian metaphor, Harry had to die to save the wizarding world. In a similar manner that this quest had to be undertaken to retrieve the Grail to save the Fisher King. And in any quest, death is, you know, part of it.
I think that another part of the Holy Grail we haven't touched on yet is the fact that in the legend of the Holy Grail, this Grail is supposed to grant immortality to whoever drinks from this cup. Well, in essence, Helga Hufflepuff's cup actually grants Voldemort a kind of immortality by having his soul resting in it.
Well, in the original legend of the Holy Grail, the immortality that the Grail provided was immortality in the blood of Christ. So it was more a religious metaphor. In La Morte d'Arthur, it's just a lot of the religious overtones are removed, and it's made more of a chalice of healing, a magical chalice.
Well, we've talked a lot about the Arthurian mythology and legends that come up in the Harry Potter books, but there's a lot of other references, such as ancient Egyptian, like the Sphinx in the Harry Potter maze. There's a reference to that, and the Sphinx is not only from ancient Egyptian mythology, but it's also in ancient Greek mythology.
Yes, Oedipus. Oedipus is on his way home, the Sphinx, tormenting that city, and he then answers the riddle of the Sphinx, and is then allowed to come home, and the Sphinx takes off.
Which is what happens in the maze. Harry answers the question, and is allowed to pass. There's all kinds of references to Greek mythology in the names of a lot of the characters. They're names of stars, but they're also derived from Greek mythologies.
Oh, absolutely. Well, like, say, Luna. Luna is actually the Latin word for the moon, but it's also the source derived for lunatics, and because she seems to be touched by a kind of insanity. But there was this kind of story around that the insane also had a type of sight, that they could see things other people couldn't. Which, if you remember, is one of the things that let her see Thestrals, is because of her familiarity with death.
And even in the books, it doesn't really do it, but Luna has supposedly sees these things that aren't there, like all kinds of, like, Nargles. She sees Nargles, and nobody else believes in them. But in the movies, it actually does show that when she puts on these special glasses from this magazine called The Quibbler, which her father is the editor of, it's basically the wizarding equivalent to a trashy rag, she is able to see these Nargle creatures, which nobody else still is going to believe that she does, but in essence, it's like they're actually there. So she sees something that's not there. She's got that third sight.
Yeah, that sight. And just in the fact that she sees Thestrals is something that if Harry hadn't have witnessed Cedric's death, he wouldn't have been able to see them the next year, and thus the same year he is introduced to Luna. Then that kind of puts Luna in this interesting place of, well, if these Thestrals that she says she sees exist, and Harry now sees them, what else is she seeing that no one else sees?
that may or may not actually exist. She provides an interesting question, and that's actually tied to a lot of mythology as well. There's oftentimes the wise fool. And if you look in, say, King Lear, to draw from Shakespeare, there's the wise fool in there who tries to help Lear deal with what he's doing and tries to hold a mirror up so Lear can see what he has become and what he is creating around him.
And I would say that going back to Shakespeare, that there is definitely probably references to Shakespeare, even like in the 6th book, Harry sees that something's happening with Draco, that there's something going on, but nobody else believes him, but he's kind of waffling back and forth. Is it going on? Is it not? Am I supposed to follow this? And kind of like Hamlet waffles a little bit about whether he should avenge his father's death, whether it was really a ghost or maybe it was a demon, or if he needs to do this or if he's not supposed to because it would be bad.
Draco makes a very interesting Ophelia, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
And in a way, there's that, if you look at it from a Hamlet point of view, Draco would be, to a degree, more like Ophelia in the fact that there's something about the two of them that keeps drawing them together and shoving each other apart. And to a degree, since Draco slowly got more mad over the course of the series, a lot of the times because he kept getting put in these moral situations where what he knew and what he was being asked to do were against each other quite a bit. I mean, especially listening to stuff from his dad, and that would mess anyone up.
Well, we talked a lot about the different myths and legends and illusions that there are in the stories, but let's go back to what do you think it does to these stories to have all these references and illusions within them?
Well, if you listen to the works of Joseph Campbell, he talks about how mythology is essential to anyone's existence, and it helps you grow. Since the Potter stories are essentially coming-of-age narratives of a boy coming into his identity and into his power, then they're pulling from information that is really core to a number of mythologies and a number of mythological cycles. Almost any story out there pulls from these allusions to older stories, to mythological stories, to create something greater than what there was at first. Because without these allusions, some of the texts just don't have as much depth. They're just more surface and less interesting, actually.
You're an English scholar, so how did you actually react when reading the books and discovering all these references to other works of literature? Did you recognize them right away, or was it more upon rereading the stories that you realized the things that they were talking about?
When I first read the story, I was reading the first one, Philosopher's Stone. I was reading it, and I was actually kind of amused and thought this was really kind of neat. You know, oh, it's very, you know, traditional tropes. Oh, the orphan treated like, you know, terribly. You know, this is all so very normal, very normal. And then I hit Nicholas Flamel. Nicholas Flamel was an actual person who tried, alchemist, who tried to convert lead into gold. And so that pulled in, you know, some interesting depth. And I was like, huh, this is interesting. Trying to do something pulling from actual information. And that got me interested in looking at the different information that could be layered into the story. And then, you know, Fluffy was also lovely as a three-headed dog, you know, similar to Cerberus from the Greek underworld. Which, in fact, is what he was in this story, too. They had to go down a hatch at Fluffy's feet, therefore entering the underworld. That was the maze to guard the Philosopher's Stone.
You're working on a book yourself. Do you draw inspiration from the Harry Potter books the same way the Harry Potter books drew from stories before them?
No, what I write is a lot more mainstream. It's more contemporary fiction than fantasy fiction. What I do draw from, though, is Rowling's work she did in trying to sell the story. I mean, she tried to sell it for so long, and there was so many troubles in trying to sell it, and it took forever for it to be sold, but she kept believing in it. She kept trying. And that's also something Harry does. He keeps believing. He keeps trying. And that is something I draw from more than material from the story to go into my stories, but I draw from material in the story that help drive me.
Thank you so much for talking to me about the different myths and legends in the Harry Potter books.
You are quite welcome.
I I would first like to say a big thank you to all my listeners out there. Thank you for making Potterwatch Radio a huge success. And thank you for being loyal listeners. Potterwatch Radio will be going on hiatus until after the holidays. Keep checking in as we get ready to come back in the new year. Don't miss us.